I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome, as ever, to the Motorsport Magazine podcast. It's the last one of the year, and I can tell you we've saved the best till last, so I think you're really going to enjoy this one. We're actually in the headquarters of the Williams Formula One team with Sir Frank himself. And of course, Motorsport Magazine being Motorsport, you'll remember it used to be Williams Grand Prix Engineering. That's how we always remember it anyway. So welcome. And before we begin, let me tell you about quickly about our subscription offer at the moment, which is if you subscribe for 12 or 24 editions, you will save up to 24% on the newsstand price. And you will receive an exclusive Motorsport whiskey tumbler absolutely free of charge. So there's a last minute Christmas present for you. Subscribe to Motorsport and get a whiskey tumbler. Just go to our website, motorsportmagazine.com/XMP13, or you can call us on 0207 349 8490. Anyway, Frank, thank you very, very much for this. Good to see you.
Thank you very much, dear.
We're going to talk about the past today, actually. Just so everybody knows, was there a moment in your early life when you thought, right, I'm going to go motor racing?
I think hard to the answer to that question. I always followed motor racing in the water sport when I was at boarding school. And as soon as I left school, my mother ran a school for mentally retarded children outside in Nottinghamshire. And the country, I used to hitchhike from there weekends to go to Silverstone or whatever. So I'm becoming quite addicted to racing. When did I start myself racing? I saw advertising Autosport, an Austin A35 brackets X Graham Hill, 400 quid, and I thought, well, I'll probably get 60 or 70 quid from my savings, put the rest on the HP. My mother guaranteed the HP payments, and I went off with a friend of mine. He drove me down there, and we bought the car, and I drove it back. We had black roundels on. I was a real ball racer. Black roundels on the side, very noisy. Stick on number plates in those days, no proper number plates. I drew a lot of attention to myself as I drove it back. But I began to race that car, and from then on, things happened, yeah.
At what stage did it occur to you to run a team as opposed to race a car? Because they're very different things, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it was Piers Courage. That's right. He'd been driving a McLaren Formula 2 car in 67. Then he drove for BRM in 68 and didn't do very well at all. It looked like his career was falling apart. In the meantime, at the same time in 68, he was driving BRM. He drove a Formula 2 car for me, and I kind of liked that very much, so the sort of entering part of it. So I found myself buying, with what I can't remember, a one-year-old Formula One Brabham, which, to the fury of Ron Tornack of Brabham, because he'd sold that car to a hill climber, thinking, could I, because it was a current car. They decided to race the 68 car in 69, but I bought the hill climb car, and I had the same identical car as the works cars. So we beat them a few times too.
And I never knew either how you did a deal with, I mean, A, also you got Cosworths, And you had the only other Dunlop deal, didn't you, apart from Ken?
Yeah. Well, I think Dunlop was down, and Piers Courage was very well highly regarded.
Yeah.
For competitive reasons, I think social reasons at the hierarchy in Dunlop at the time. I opened quite a few doors, bless him. And the engine was just go to Cosworth, you've got the money, they'll take your money and give you some engines. Yeah.
Looking back, Frank, running a team has always been tremendously demanding, hasn't it? I mean, do you have any one single regret about it all or not? Or have you really loved it all?
Well, I'm not one for looking back. I mean, the mistakes you made, one generally, you're a big human, one learns from them. And in fact, the whole business of entering Formula One was not really pre-planned, because Piers Courage had a shocking season, partly self-created, driving a Formula 2 car, the BRM, with the Parnell BRM, that was it. And his career needed rescuing, and he was a great friend, and he was driving for me at the time in Formula 2. And I just bought from a hill climb guy, a wealthy man called Bridges, Jeff Bridges of Brabham, which he had just bought from Ron Tornack, a 68 Brabham. And the Brabhams, Ronda decided that the 68 Brabham was good enough to race in 69. So he's updated the last year's cars. And the car he sold to the hill climb man suddenly, when it really pissed him off, turned up in the hands of a private entity called Frank Williams for Piers Courage. So he was very unhappy. Jack Brabham were even more so, but that's just happened. Yeah.
I was something I don't think I've ever asked you. Has there been one day, a single day, that you would say was the best day you've had in racing? I mean, was it Clay at Silverstone? Because
it was probably Clay.
Because it just struck me when Rob was doing his intro about the subscription and the Scotch class. I remember after the race, and of course it was much more informal in those days. I don't think there was any sort of press conference or anything. But I remember, as a lifelong non-smoking teetotaler, somebody thrust into your hand a cigar in one hand and a glass of scotch.
Don't remember.
And you did very gamely, I think.
Scotch?
You did sip the scotch,
yeah. I smoked the fag, did I?
It wasn't a fag, it was a cigar.
Even worse, yeah.
No, I think you sort of waved it around a bit. But
I don't remember. I remember the whiskey.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah, that's actually the only time I've ever.
It was just in a tent. Do you remember? There was no. It was so relaxed and.
My real memory of drinking whiskey was the only way you get the crazy horse suit in Paris, is by buying a drink of whiskey. So I had to do that. Yeah.
I mean, you said there was no press conference. When I was spectating, it was just before I started as a journalist, and I was spectating the day at Beckett's, and Clay came round, I think, sitting on top of an Austin Princess. With Jean-Pierre Gerrier and the post-race celebration, rather than being ushered up a set of stairs into a very formal thing, they were put on the back or roof of an Austin Princess and taken round the circuit.
Yeah, that's right. And then taken back to this tent. Yes, it was hard to believe now in these days of the wing, isn't it?
Well, we could say those were the days, but then, as you say, you don't really like looking back. So the obvious next thing to ask you is, do you still get the same thrill out of going Grand Prix racing as you always have done?
Yeah, it's truthfully, I really enjoy my life. I mean, enormously enjoy my life. I couldn't think of anything else I would have done. The only thing I did think of was, when I was young, I was trying to join the Air Force and fly fighters, but I'm useless at maths and physics, so I had no chance of getting up in the air. So I just found, happily and luckily, away into motor racing bit by bit.
Your own days when you were driving, it's always struck me as a great omission in the sort of literature of motor racing is nobody has ever written a definitive book about the days of the Continental Circus, you know, the F3, which you were highly involved in.
Yeah.
Because there's so many wonderful stories, you know, from that era. Yeah. And
well, there probably are a lot of anecdotal things that went on when I can't remember most of them.
I remember you telling me one about Piers in the pyjamas.
It was a friend of his called Eddie.
Oh, was it?
Yeah,
oh, I thought it was Piers.
No. Well, Piers copied him in the end, just to sort of bring attention to himself, bless him. But there was this Englishman called Ed, and forgive me, his name will come back, who used to, he slept in a tent, but he insisted on going to bed in pyjamas. Yes. Yeah, that's right. He didn't appear in the morning a little sleepily, and he staggered off to the washrooms in an autobahn. If he was kipping there the night, in the Rast House place. You go in there, and couldn't care less. Just brush his teeth, have a shave, come back out again. Then go back in for breakfast after his rest. Eddie, someone who come back to me. He was well known in the F3 circuit in the late 60s.
I can't remember it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But it was a pretty gypsy way of life, though, wasn't it? Sort of just going from one town to another, to another, to another, and highly dangerous circuits.
I just say it was an itinerant way of life.
But it was also
we did have a shower every day.
Yeah. But it was also romantic in a way, because you were like a band of brothers travelling around Europe, and whereas nowadays drivers are, you know, need a wealthy sponsor, a wealthy father, whatever, I mean, in those days you were paid start money quite often to, you could actually make a living.
Yes, it was
living this gypsy lifestyle.
A sort of gypsy lifestyle, yes, it was fun most of the time. We're all young, fairly irresponsible, and we all dreamt of motor racing and becoming stars in Formula One. Most people didn't make it, but we had a great trip along the way, which I never would regret. In fact, it opened doors to get me here today. Piers had a bad time, and I had a car in stock, and I said, "Oh, I'll lend you a car. Let's go do the Formula 3 race." And I couldn't stop.
Frank, everybody knows that a huge turning point in the history of Williams was the arrival of Patrick Head.
Absolutely. Night became day.
Night became day, yes. What do you remember?
Actually, I think his wife's maiden name was Day, but never care off somebody. It was a day somewhere in that family.
What do you remember of your first meeting with him when you made an approach to him for him to come and work with you?
It was Guy Edwards who said, "Good guy, Patrick Head, da 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 da." I said, "If I get a meeting," I said, "Where is he?" He said, "Well, he's into yachts at the moment. He'll be messing about with his boat." And sure enough, this jaunty sailor-looking bloke turned up, paint all over his pullover, some well-worn-out sand shoes with no laces, and this was Patrick. Well, it wasn't just the truth, but it was a great conversation. It just happened. We just clicked. He was obviously very intelligent.
The anecdote Patrick always tells about that first meeting, from his point of view, he says he remembers you saying to him, "Are you prepared to work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?" Well, I said, "No, of course I'm not. And if you have to, they're not running things very well."
Something, yeah.
Is that accurate?
He was trying to dominate from the start by giving me a bollocking.
apart from his obvious abilities technically, what was the secret of the relationship? Because it lasted a hell of a long time, didn't it?
What was the Well, first of all, he was everything a team principal could wish for. He was dynamic, he was very intelligent, but very, very practical. He could weld, he could do very much anything on a racing car himself, and raced his own car. He was a very, very capable sailor. So he knew how to deal with most things in the world, except maybe commercial matters to me. And we knew our places in the team, so to speak, and we sort of connected very well. I did my part, got a bit of luck on my side with the Saudis, etc., at very much the appropriate moment. And Patrick delivered everything he delivered, which was an outstanding racing car in its day. There was a class of the field for about 2 years, yeah.
Well, how much did this place change when he left, if at all?
Well, he stood down, and he still was present, from I remember, many days a week on outside projects. He still comes in very frequently. But it's fair to say it was not quite the same. And Patrick was a tough guy. You knew when he was coming down the corridor. His voice, bless him, being a sailor, his voice generally preceded him. And he had this habit of sort of beating the sides of the wall as he went along. I was about to begin to indulge in jungle warfare, and all this shit, everybody was going to my office. If I'd been more mobile, I'd have been out that door a bit more often. excuse my language. fantastic partner.
Would I be right in thinking that you've always enjoyed a feisty chap, in the sense, I'm thinking of Alan Jones, we've talked about Patrick Head, I guess I'm not sure Nigel Mansell was feisty, but he was certainly
Keke was certainly feisty.
Keke was certainly feisty. Yeah, would that be true, Frank?
I didn't choose them. The drivers come here because they think they get a better car here. The press they on offer to them elsewhere, let's say. And you know, the drivers have come across the door here have generally been very desirable drivers. It's not as I'm going to have to go out and be very persuasive. It's the quality of our equipment, in fact, for any team, that would attract drivers. We're not renowned for paying particularly well. But, of course, Patrick, in his day, set a standard of racing cars with his active ride car that really was a big step. And then Adrian picked it up, made it even better. So we became a very desirable part of the planet for quite some time.
Do you remember feeling a major sense of almost relief once Patrick came on board? Because you talk about drivers coming to you, good drivers coming to you, but in the early 70s, during the previous iteration of Williams, I mean, you had some very good people, Jacques Lafitte, Tony Pryce, but also you had quite a few winter drivers. Was it a sense of relief once things started to pick, a major sense of, did you feel a major change?
Yes, that was a very spot-on question. Patrick brought everything this team was missing, which was law and order, technically. That's the majority of it all, really. I was wandering around, stumbling from sort of mistake to mistake, and it being pretty evident to. But Patrick was a properly qualified, university-qualified mechanical engineer with a sound practical approach and a strong discipline to what he thought a piece of metal could and couldn't do. And he applied that and he made superb racing cars. And when Adrian died, our strength doubled and the history really got good for us.
When it came to choosing drivers, Frank, was Patrick very much involved in that, was choice of drivers always very much your domain?
Well, no, I had the final call, but we discussed it. We generally met on drivers. I don't think, in fact, the choice in the marketplace is never good because you will never find six superstar drivers on the market at any one time. You know, maybe Vettel might become free at the end of the year, but Webber and three others won't come free at the same time, as an instance. So one has to be alert at all times.
We've got a question. We've got a lot of questions from our readers, you won't be surprised to know. But this one comes actually from a Brazilian chap called Mario Carneiro Neto. And he wonders, Frank, if you could say a little bit about Brazilian drivers. Because, you know, you've had three or four and about to have a fifth. Is there something about the Brazilians that is a bit different, do you think, or not?
Well, it's an interesting question because it's obvious that Brazil has thrown out some very good and brilliant, indeed, racing drivers, Emerson and so on, and Nelson. These are world-class drivers. And we were fortunate to obtain the services of some of those along the way, Pache, etc. But why this is, you can't say. I mean, if they all came from Finland and black ice and snow and rain, you'd understand it. But there's almost there's none of that down there that I've ever seen. There's a lot of rain, mind you, but undrivable rain. I don't know what the answer is to that. Unless they're used to driving dreadfully. Well, they all drove a sort of version of a Volkswagen when they were young, didn't they?
Yeah.
And I suppose if you survive that at high speed, you're for your first step to glory.
A lot of them, though, seem to have.
I won't be persecuted or criticised, or what's the word, prosecuted by Volkswagen, by having said that.
You won't be. Other cars are available, yes. But they also, apart from the driving side of it, though, many of them seem to have a certain, there's a sort of aura about them, isn't there? Or do you think that's a media dreamt up thing? They seem to have a certain calmness, a certain presence.
I've no wisdom on that. I would just say Emerson Fittipaldi seemed to have a little bit of an aura, as if he knew without being conceited about it, he was a bit different. He was certainly very intelligent. Carlos Patchin, no, I wouldn't have said so. Certainly Ayrton was very special, intellectually very gifted, a lot of presence. He had aura.
Right.
Nigel, he was a brute force. He was unstoppable. And he came from a different direction, but he was just as effective.
Apart from when he was waving to the crowd.
Oh, yeah, sure, that's
right. The race
or falling over on the podium steps in Monaco.
No, it was a fantastic.
Actually, once we start getting into this, we...
I wonder if perhaps Mansell is still underrated. What do you feel about that?
Well, I think he could have been better. I think he left. I can't remember what the circumstances were when he left. I think he left. We annoyed him about somebody decided to go because he threw his overalls off and this and that at the end of his last race or something, gave everything away. Can't quite remember. But if he'd stayed longer, he would have done better, I think.
He went straight to the States to drive for Newman Haas.
He put his own extinguishers in light, really, which he shouldn't have done.
And then he came back for that brief period. Well, he came back to you, in fact, after Ayrton's accident, didn't he? For half a season.
Yeah, sure.
And then, had that brief couple of races with McLaren, and that was that. Yeah. Actually, Frank, I must say, I people might laugh at this, but the driver, we talk about underrated drivers, underrated by history. I think Alan Jones is one. And I, oddly enough, I also think the other is Prost. I think Prost's name doesn't come up instantly to a lot of people when they think about the great drivers of history. And I can't imagine why.
But jolly well should do.
Well, I'll tell you, partly why, certainly as a character, Alan was very understated.
Yeah.
Very quiet and understated, almost shy. But, I mean, just extremely clever man. Very, very special in a car. I think, he took as few risks as he's failed to get away with without damaging his pace. I mean, he's very careful on the track.
And I think the other thing was that he made it look so easy, didn't he? That's why people tend perhaps to not remember.
There was never a drama when he was driving.
No, sure.
Do you think there's a thing, if we look at Grand Prix racing today compared to, say, 30 years ago, the amount of technology that's available now, both to the team and the driver. Do you still think that a great driver can make a real difference? Is that always going to be the case, do you think?
If a driver steps out, a great driver steps out of the world's best racing car and goes one row back, he'll still be probably a winner. If he goes five rows back in any season, he'd probably struggle to win a race. There's a bit of a difference. I mean, what's our car? 1 second off the pace, probably?
Sure.
And maybe more.
Sure.
And we're trying to help to catch up, but we're failing. Let's just say we hope we'll get there eventually again. But, I think Adrian should be banned.
Well, that was,
just pay him off, give him 50 million quid to go and have a holiday.
I think Red Bull does give him 50 million, don't
they? Yeah, no, lovely guy, a lovely man. He's totally unspoiled.
Yeah.
It's just incredibly innocent. I mean, it's just, well, I like that.
He is presumably the most valuable man in the paddock.
He has to be, absolutely.
Yeah.
But based on what you've just said, Frank, I mean, can we judge, say, Vettel without, if he hasn't raced another type of car? What's your view on that?
I think that even without Adrian, he'd still win races. He'd find it harder, and he certainly wouldn't win anything like as many, but I think he'd still be a top man for winning a championship. Yeah.
And four in a row.
I'll put it this way. If he had a row with his governor and he said, I'm not driving next year, and we came on the marketplace, there'd be a rush.
Yes.
There'd be a rush, yeah.
You'd be at the head of the queue, no doubt.
Well, the thing is, I could not spend Ferrari, could I?
Probably not, no.
It would be the top of the queue, I would imagine, yeah.
Frank, you said a couple of minutes ago that if Nigel had stayed, you think he could have continued to flourish in Formula One.
Yes.
Are there any drivers in particular that you... I mean, there have been some very good guys who've left you just after winning a championship. Piquet, Hill, Mansell, etc. I mean, are there any guys you particularly wish you'd been able to hold on to at the time? Because there have been quite a few who've won a title with Williams and then moved on.
I think obviously Nigel was regrettable that he chose to leave when he did. Alan Prost, did he retire when he left us?
He did.
But in fact, I mean, that was what Nigel's leaving was all about, wasn't it? It was Alan's coming to the team for 93.
And then I think Alan's departure was triggered by Ayrton coming.
That's right, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you something about looking back to the beginning of Williams? I've read the book, and how you ever found K kept finding the money, I still don't quite understand. But
I knew lots of Peters and lots of Pauls.
I still don't understand. Will it always be like Premiership football or any other world top level sport? Will always be a constant search to be able to afford it? And how much longer do you think this type of spending can go on?
Well, I've always thought on that issue, there'll always be trouble finding money. There always is money in the world. The clever guys will always find enough at the right time, even if it's just in time. And the evidence is that is correct.
But the technology, though, demands more and more money, doesn't it? In the beginning, you had a Cosworth engine. The cars were relatively straightforward, although Patrick, of course, introduced the skirts and the ground, which was a new technology. But the pace of technology is so rapid now, isn't it, it demands greater and greater.
Yes, but the regulations are very, very tightly controlled. To prevent mad, endless expenditure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Having said that, there's no substitute for outstanding brain power. Witness that fine, thin Englishman, who is very shy, who's got an extraordinary understanding of airflow.
I think, you know, people in the outside world, Frank, who know a little bit about racing but not much, what they really struggle to understand is how can it make sense financially or any other way to have wind tunnels going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and what does that in the end give to the people who go and watch
if
it?
If it's too much, I'll leave. I don't want to leave. I want to win.
Yeah.
And I'll work very hard. The money's out there. We can find the money.
Yes, sure.
And other people like me think and do the same.
Do you not think that there's been perhaps the last few years just too much emphasis on aerodynamics? Because one thing I'm looking forward to next year is
we might actually
see cars overtake each other in a straight line next year, just by virtue of having more horsepower.
Yeah, sure.
Which would make
an unusual
spectacle.
Well, certainly the current cars really have not seen much of an excess of horsepower over adhesion, if you like. But next year might be different, yeah. Hope so.
I like the sound of this four times as much torque.
Okay. Yeah. That'd be very interesting to watch.
Can we take another reader's question, Frank? This is Sami Ahmed, and he wonders if the relationship with BMW, had it lasted longer, might it have won you another constructor's title?
Well, it's impossible to answer that. They had very clever people there, very competitive, rich company, make a lot of horsepower on their engines. If they'll ever come back, I've not the slightest idea. Great brand for Formula One.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure. And Honda now, of course, coming back, and the company you know.
They're real racers, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember when in 86, that was it. Nigel was already signed up, and they were keen to get Nelson. And I could sign Nelson about 12:30 in the local hotel at Suzuka or something, I can't remember. And I told the boss guy, was waiting for me to come back from the meeting, I said, it's done. He knocked on all the doors, and there were about 30 Japanese came out in their pyjamas and their knickers, and all that in a mess. You know what I mean? I was absolutely thrilled to bits. Just dedicated to winning. It was very impressive, actually.
Actually, it's something. I think it's a very interesting area. The emphasis you just put on that word "races" is really. I mean, it's what it's all about from the bottom up and the top down, isn't it? It's that absolute desire to win.
Well, it's a twin thing. It's absolute desire to go racing. I mean, look at him. He's just a racer through and through. Always will be till we bury him. Sorry, you know what I mean, Nigel, in a nice way. Look, quite a few people who are totally sincere and live for Formula One, as people do for football or athletics. It's a healthy business, healthy thing. And I think just with the technology that goes along with motor racing, that is part of it. It's an amazing job, amazing business. It has its followers, that's for sure.
I think it was Bill Shankly who said that football isn't a matter of life and death. It's much more important than that.
Yes. Very good, brilliant quote.
Absolutely.
Yeah, real, very good.
But, Frank, I mean, I always think of you fundamentally as a purist when it comes to racing.
I don't think many young ladies think that. When I was younger, ladies.
And I wonder, I mean, there are several aspects of contemporary Formula One that I find offensive, like I find DRS offensive, because to me it's a gimmick, and it's reduced the importance of overtaking, I think.
Sure.
So things like that, and all sorts of things that are potentially, you know, on the table for discussion for the future, like, you know, stipulating how many pit stops you must have. I mean, it seems to me to be tampering with something that...
Well, they are. It's for the show.
Yeah, I know.
Which had become a bit routine.
Yeah, but it still was reality. I mean, it may have been boring for Vettel to win 9 on the trot.
I think what drove it was the fact that to some extent... At least half a dozen cars out there are fairly similar, but Red Bull accepted a very similar performance, and overtaking was a problem.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. No, I do appreciate that. But it seems as instead of attacking the fundamental problem, which is really, I mean, it is the aerodynamics.
Too much wing.
Well, that's what prevents.
Too much wing, that's right, yeah.
Rather than addressing the fundamental problem, it just seems to be sort of tinkering with gimmicky.
Yeah.
And it seems to be getting so much more complicated than it was. It was just for people to follow, people sitting at home who know a little bit about it. There are so many more rules now than there were.
Yeah.
I just wondered if you had an opinion about the way it was going.
Well, I suppose people tend to look only at the problem that's just at hand without looking at ongoing consequences. They might fix the problem in immediate, simple terms, but it has long-term consequences, like overtaking, etc. It depends. I think the whole thing is driven by TV figures. And if Bernie walks in and says, "Oh, TV figures are disastrous," and the sponsor at the same time is saying, "Not going to pay you 40 million any other good look at this, just will not do it." You know, people like you and everybody else get paid a lot of attention and agree to anything. That's the cycle.
Similar things are happening in other top level sports, aren't they? I mean, there isn't a single English player in the Manchester City football team, for example.
Wow.
I mean,
that's embarrassing.
But it's all about money, isn't
it? I say.
Yeah.
It's the richest club as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Abu Dhabi, yeah.
Frank, just before we finish, can I come back to another question from Arida, because they're keen to obviously hear what you have to say. And if you went over to the museum, and would there be one or maybe two cars in there that would make you pause and smile and think?
Yeah, the first 07 and the first 07 was the 86 car, FW11. Because they pissed on everybody. As simple as that. It's just human nature. You tell that the speed response is the automatic response. Yeah.
Well, no, I thought you might say that. I just
the good news about that is an Englishman and both
of
similar attitude and stature.
Absolutely.
Alan and Nigel.
They seem to be rather
Australian.
Those types of Englishmen seem to be rather few and far between.
Sadly.
Pit lane these days, in my opinion.
Yeah.
On the same theme of you love those cars because they pissed on the rest of the field, what's it been like the last few years for someone who's so focused on winning to see your team?
Well, that's the other side of the coin. I was mentioned I'm being pissed on. It's my turn to be pissed on. I'm excited. That's how it happens, isn't it? That's how it happens. As simple as that. Sort yourself out, Frankie boy. That's what the answer is. Yeah.
And you are, I'm sure.
I was plodding along the way. Yeah.
Okay.
Unless you can ban Adrian Newey.
I personally
can't. Everybody else would like to be different.
I'd quite like to as well.
The thing I love about Adrian is just totally unspoiled. I probably said it before, but
yeah,
just no conceit whatsoever.
Mind you, if he was down in the workshop, you wouldn't want to ban him, would you?
No.
But he's worth more than any driver, isn't he?
Of course he is.
Without a doubt.
Sure, yeah.
Maybe it'll all change next year.
Why has I got a manager?
Well, I think we should say on behalf of all everybody who reads or looks at Motorsport magazine, thank you for a fantastic team for an amazingly long time. And it's been, you know, surprising number of people absolutely love the Williams team. Well, you're aware of that, I guess.
I'm not, because I mean, how can I be if you follow me? I mean, I'm remote like many people in the team. We go to the pits, lock ourselves in the pits, and inaccessible, and then rush off to the airport.
Well, Frank, I remember that day at Silverstone in 79 when Clay won. It was your first win. And I remember people fairly sort of, you know, cynical, hardened people in the press room in tears at the end of that race.
Really?
Yeah.
It's probably because I heard the money, Nigel. Don't be confused.
I mean, it's not something you very often see in the press room, that. But just because everybody was so thrilled for you.
That's very kind. Yes,
but, I mean, it was a similar thing, actually, in Spain in 2012, when Pasta won. I mean, the reaction in the press room at the end of the race, again, because, you know, it had been such a long time coming. And it was the same thing. You don't often get cheers and applause in the press room, ever, in fact. But 2012 in Spain.
That's very nice. I don't know that. Thank you very much for telling me.
I remember coming here 2-3 years ago and interviewing various members of the team, and I spoke to Tom McCulloch, who's now gone on to
lovely guy.
Tom was telling me how he'd been offered a job by Jag, but he didn't really want to work for Jag. He wanted to work for you. And he kind of talked his way into reception and managed to blag a conversation with Sam Michael. And, you know, just said, look, I'll take this job with Jag, but please, can't I work for you instead? And you know, next thing, here he is. And that kind of passion, I think, just tells you everything you need to know about the team.
I bet you can't wait for next season.
That is the case. Well, it always is the case, actually.
Absolutely.
Well, the reason I hesitate, I'm just thinking, because how good do I think or know a car really is going to be? That's the biggest concern for everybody.
Sure.
Whether they weren't, how good is your kit?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But that's all very much part of the excitement, too.
Yes, yes, yes. But particularly next year, of course. Okay, thank you very much, Frank. Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's it for today. We've been at the Williams Formula One factory in Grove in Oxfordshire. And we'll be back next year with more monthly podcasts from Motorsport Magazine. Thank you very much for joining us. Have a great Christmas. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.